org. That's DEL at KABU.org. More information about responsibilities and position requirements can be found at KABU.FM.
This is KBOO Portland.
Okay, on that note, here we are. Yeah, that's what I feel about this situation. I'm Paul Roland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Be with you until 9 o'clock. When politics of living comes your way, women's voices and opinions on economic, social, and cultural issues, followed by Air Cascadia. And then Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein and The Bike Show, and then I think Jazz in the Afternoon. Afternoon. All right, so yeah, what are we prepared to do? Good question. All right, so I got sparked by a couple themes, questions, ideas that I want to throw out for our conversation today. I'd like it if you would engage me. Let's have some good arguments today. 503-231-8187. Let's really get into it. All right, so one of them, something that Chris Layman said, the author of The Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream, who I interviewed during a membership drive a month or so ago. Great book, by the way. Still haven't finished it, but I've gotten a lot out of the 4, 5, 6 chapters I have read. Anyway, so he said something very provocative. We were kind of at the very tail end. We were talking about how his view of Marxism, that we agreed that Marx was a truly brilliant analyzer of economics and power relations and certain fundamental concepts that are kind of hidden to view unless you unpack them, I guess, as the modern term is, like the commodity fetishism, and other such things. The rate of profit, he did extraordinary research for years at the, mostly at the London Library, I believe, and did a real service to humankind by compiling statistics, detailed statistics and trends, and putting them into his framework, his model of history and society, and giving it to the working people as a tool to understand their position in the world with an eye to changing that position. But he also did have a progressivist view of history. The idea, well, you know, there's difference of opinion about how much and whether he changes views over time, but a lot of people took up the idea that there's these immutable stages of history from so-called, the primitive horde through the archaic state to feudalism and capitalism, that he saw as basically a necessary, he saw there's a sort of a necessity in history that we had to go through these stages and to reach the utopian endpoint of communism. And he called the original kind of tribal life, based upon his reading of Lewis Morgan, kind of proto-anthropologist, his reading of his research into the Iroquois society and some other American indigenous cultures, he termed them primitive communism, but still that was a stage that he thought needed to be superseded. Well, I don't believe that at all. I think that's entirely wrong. I think that this entire excursion into mass hierarchical centralized militaristic society has been a terrible, terrible, I don't know if you could call it a mistake. It happened. Certainly is leading us on to disaster as we see the final fruits of the process, the cumulative impact of all the interventions into the natural world and technological developments, bringing on rapidly accelerating climate change and the utter devastation of species life on planet Earth. Anyway, so what did Chris Layman say? Well, he said that, Marx, we're talking, because this book is a lot about how basically Christianity sort of morphed into capitalism, in a sense, or they merged. There's different views on that. Walter Benjamin thinks that actually capitalism was basically a direct outgrowth of Christianity. I think Chris might have a somewhat different view, that there's more of a merging, basically in the American colonies. Anyway, long story that you should read fully in reading the Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking the American Dream. So, okay, Chris Layman, we're talking about the Marx's dictum that religion is the opiate of the masses, opiate of the people. And he said, Chris, that he thinks progress is the opiate of, I think he said, liberal intellectuals. He could have just said liberals. He could have, I guess if he had said progressives, that's kind of a tautology. Progress is the opiate of progressives. Anyway, that's a provocative thing I'd like to throw out there. This idea that, oh, it's going to get better. We just have to do things. We have to tweak the process. And, you know, really there is progress, you know, despite all the terrible things, that we're moving in a better direction. I think that's a crock myself. I think that, I don't know, I spent a lot of time before I went off to Italy, the land of my father. I spent a lot of time with the native people of the Pacific Northwest, and I don't know, I think they actually had it pretty darn good before Whitey arrived, before we arrived, Europeans, and dismantled that life ways. And I think those were the ways that had been adapted to this place for over millennia and millennia, and had demonstrated themselves to be successful. And we, what have we done? We've dammed the rivers, killed the salmon, driven innumerable species to the brink of extinction, wiped out the ancient forests, wiped out most of the original ecosystems. Of course, we did that all the way across the continent. So, okay, progress is the opiate of, I don't know, people who listen to KABU, maybe. What do you think? And the other thing I was that got me going, I was listening to the Abe and Joe talk show yesterday, and they're talking about the dismal state of Trumplandia and how he seems to be this race of a move towards a greater authoritarianism and virtual dictatorship. Oh, the idea that he thinks he can pardon himself. I think that was one of the starting points of the conversation. And the fact that, you know, basically the Republicans, they're kind of in hostage to each other. The Republicans are in hostage to Trump because he was the only guy who could demonstrate the ability to win the nomination. And he's in hostage to what? The Russian mafia, the other mafias, the certain banks. You know, he's up to his eyeballs in debt. Seems like things were probably going to come crashing down. This is somewhat of a desperate move. Either, you know, he didn't win and it gave him a whole boost of publicity they could cash in on, like he did with the television show The Apprentice. So anyway, they're basically using each other, and now they're kind of stuck with each other, and they're kind of trapped because they can't really go back, and there doesn't seem to be the ability to impeach him, which does seem to be the thing to do given the crimes that seem to be coming out. So anyway, that's what the Abe and Joe were talking about in a. So, they're talking about the constitutional crisis. So they talked about that on Democracy Now!, I believe, yesterday. I know people have been talking about this for months now, but it does seem to be coming to a head. And anyway, Joe came out with the we need to save the system. Of course, he meant, you know, the constitutional system. But I don't know. Is this system worth saving? Again, you know, so is it going to... Assuming that I don't know what scenario you prefer, that Trump is impeached, that Trump and Pence are hung up by whatever, I don't know, that you know, some sort of semblance of what we're more used to in the presidential role, in the balances of power and all that, if so, that's some sort of normalcy is restored, are we going to stave off accelerating climate change? Are we going to bring back the accelerating number of species that are disappearing? Are we going to reverse this bizarre technologization of the world, this sort of virtual reality that's supplanting actual reality, that's got us all dazzled and confused? Is that going to happen? I doubt it. So what system is really worth saving? And the system, I just think there's a lot of muddleheadedness about this. I don't think we really challenge ourselves enough to really see through these obfuscations. Anyway, so the system is the system that dragged off millions of Africans from their own homes and life ways in Africa and forced them to do all this labor to build up the capital to allow the United States to become this huge expansionist force on the planet, in addition to stealing this whole continent from the indigenous people who were happily living here. They had their problems, they had their squabbles, they had their wars, they had their conflicts, they had probably oppressive practices from group to group, but by and large they certainly had, I think, had figured it out a lot better than European society. That's my opinion. So yeah, what system is worth saving? Is a system worth saving? Is progress the opiate of otherwise well-thinking people like ourselves? So those are a couple themes I'm throwing out there. 503-231-8187. I think capitalism itself is a cult. I think democracy is this illusionary veneer that allows the whole thing to continue. I think it basically was enshrined in the Constitution through the commerce clause, the supremacy of interstate commerce over all else allowed the rich to continue. It was basically just a transfer of wealth and power from the British royalty and British royalty to the rising American elites. And that's the thesis of the People's History of the United States, great Howard Zinn. No surprise to any of you, but is there anything we can do about it? What are we prepared to do about it? Someone called in a few shows ago and said that people of privilege need to step up and take risks because we have all the privilege, but actually, I think historically, it's really more people who have their backs to the wall who are forced to do things. I think when you have a lot, you tend not to want to risk giving it up. I think that's more the dynamic. Sure, it'd be great if people did use their privilege to actually change the system and help people who are less privileged. Unfortunately, I just don't think that's enough of a motivating factor. I think the motivating factor is that things are going extremely dangerously bad, and some serious things that we don't seem to be capable of. There's an article here I got. Well, anyway, if nobody's calling in, 503-231-8187, I meant to actually talk about Unilever, that song by Chumbawamba, the great British anarchist band that lasted from 1982 to 2012. Where is our Chumbawamba now, I ask you? Anyway, that song was from Pictures of Starving Children Sell Records from 1986. Unilever is a British-Dutch transnational consumer goods company co-headquartered in London, UK, and Rotterdam, Netherlands. Its products include food and beverages, cleaning agents, hence whitewash, in the song, and Personal Care Products is the world's largest consumer goods company measured by 2012 revenue, and is also the world's largest producer of food spreads such as margarine. It is Europe's seventh most valuable company, is one of the oldest multinational companies. Its products are available in around 190 countries. It owns over 400 brands. And I could go on and on. Anyway, it it stands in for any corporation you want to name, or stands in for capitalism itself, this continued attempt to deflect attention from what's really going on and the sordid reality behind the wizard's machinations. So those are a couple things I threw out there. Is progress the opiate of liberal intellectuals? Is the system worth saving? I think we fundamentally painted ourselves into a corner. Of course, that's not really a strong enough metaphor. If you paint yourself into a corner, you can just, walk back over the paint and mess up your paint job. Maybe you have to redo it. Maybe get paint on your shoes. But the kind of corner we painted ourselves into, I think there's a fundamental unwillingness to actually face up to it. Because it is. It's awful scary. But the thing is, it ain't going away. All right, so another thing I want to talk about, since I haven't excited anybody to pick up their phone and dial that number and have a conversation. That's what this show is all about, having a community conversation about important things. I do a mix of particular issues. Like, I had Laura Finley on. I thought she was really amazing, sensitive observer of the social scene and great writer. She was talking about school shootings and, what creates these seemingly monstrous young males. So we were talking a lot about that. So I mix between particular issues and guests and talking what I think is more deeply, more broadly, because I don't think we have to really give ourselves enough opportunity to that. I think there may be times in history when that's more the thing to do. I think certainly the 60s was one of those times. Certainly the turn of the 19th to 20th centuries with the possibly the most revolutionary time since capitalism unfortunately came upon the scene, which of course was crushed by World War I and then the Red Scare, and then the Great Depression kind of revivified it, but it also brought in the welfare state and sort of the buying off of revolutionary movements, revolutionary impulse, revolutionary, I would say, consciousness. Something I just Googled, revolutionary consciousness. This is a couple quotes here. One from the All African People's Revolutionary Party. This is from Sekou Toure, great African revolutionary. Without revolutionary consciousness, there is no revolution. All those who have conducted revolution agree on this. But where does this revolutionary consciousness come from, since it is certain that it is not basic datum, nor does it come into being and develop spontaneously? History teaches us it is created and developed through ideological education and revolutionary practice. This is a great documentary film on Fred Hampton. And I think the centerpiece of the film is a wonderful scene where he's become at age, how old was he, 19, 20, 21? Gosh, when they killed him. He'd already established himself as a kind of a go-to leader, thinker. Anyway, some other African-American, black self-styled revolutionary group came to him, and they're talking, and he's kind of laying out, what they wanted to do. And he says, they had a detailed written sort of plan. I don't know if he was proposing sort of working together, because Hampton had the Rainbow Coalition at the time, I believe, that they're depicting the film. And the guy, he said, well, you know, where's your political education? So, oh, you know, that's just taken for granted. We do, well, you know, there's no taken for granted political education. That's like the core. So where is our political education today? You know, I know that the Democratic Socialists of America are kind of rising up in sort of in the wake of the Bernie Sanders campaign and the Trump election. And it seems like I looked at their website. They've got a lot of working groups. Sounds like they've got some political education going on there. I know there's a number of, you know, smaller, what I consider sort of sectarian, either Trotskyist, Marxist-Leninist groups. You know, all power to them. They do good work. And they have political education. They're always handing out flyers, trying to get people to come to their events. That's all to the good, but there's been times in history where they've been much more broader. I know the Ferrer schools that the anarchists had, and mostly on the East Coast, I believe, were basically schools. I know that the American Indian Movement had their survival schools. Sort of the Black Panthers had their, you know, educational component, you know, even part of their breakfast program. Some might say that was propaganda. I think it's great. I think, you know, I think kids from a very young age, I think young kids are probably a lot more open to political education than most of us older folk who've already sort of rigidified our thinking and don't tend to allow sort of new thoughts and concepts and change too much into our thinking. Anyway, that's enough of me. I guess I got three callers already on the line. Well, let's go to our first one. George, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Paul. You have put so much on our plate, and I gather from what you've been saying that not all of what you've been talking or mentioning is from the book The Money Cult. Is that true?
No. It's not.
Oh, most of it is in The Money Cult?
I was just talking extemporaneously myself.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, yeah. And you were bringing in so many important things, and I was just thinking, well, along with all of this, I think it's worth mentioning a couple of other authors, but what you brought in is so interesting and stimulating, but I know you've already probably read some of Mazzaro's stuff.
Well, I was hoping we'd actually just talk about this idea that progress is the opiate of liberal intellectuals, is the system worth saving?
Is that in? I guess Mazzaro's is saying the system is not consistent with survival of humanity.
And what's his name again?
István Mazzaro's. He's an old guy, and there's several volumes published by Monthly Review.
But what are your thoughts? What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm still working my way through some of Mazzaro's, and I'd say, well, he's saying the whole system of capital is directly opposed to the survival of the environment and human survival, and I haven't read enough to say much more. He's mostly a
philosopher. Come on, you've lived a long time. You've thought things through. What do you think about, you know?
Well, I read this, and I'm not an expert on any of it, so I get my ideas from you and Mazzaro's. And there's another book called Zombie Capitalism by Chris Harman.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, well, I'll bet you've looked through, I mean, from what you're saying, you've looked through a lot of stuff, you've read a lot of stuff, and I just wanted to throw these two authors out.
Great.
As something else to add, and I just think your program is very interesting, so I just want to hang up and listen to you now.
All right. Well, I want to actually listen to, let's see, is it John? Go ahead, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I agree with the last caller that there's a lot on the table to talk about. I'm going to go to the big picture just to make it simple for me. I came across an author named Graham Hancock from England. Have you heard of him?
Nope.
He's written lots of books, like, I don't know, five or six on ancient archaeology and studying lost, little-known manuscripts, little-known maps, stuff that we should be taught in grade school, that there's maps of the whole world that were salvaged from ancient Egypt and show places like Antarctica. And it wasn't until 1949 that they were able to prove, using high technology, that this map of Antarctica accurately shows river valleys and coastlines, because Antarctica is so covered with ice, they couldn't see that it did that. And so, you know, I find science a little irritating, because it likes to not talk about things that are hard to explain.
So bring it back to the subject at hand, if you would. Progress, is progress the opiate of the liberal intellectuals? And is a system worth saving?
I read a book, and I can't remember the name of the book, but the author wrote the book Flow and some other famous books. And this book, I think I have it in my collection somewhere. It was describing the five memes that are keeping us stuck, and I couldn't wait to get to the end of the book to find out what the solution was. And his solution was, we have to talk to our neighbors more. Well, since that book came out 20 years ago, we're not able to talk to our neighbors more. We're able to talk to our neighbors less. So I think the direction of education and communication, even though we have the tools to communicate, are somehow slipping out of our fingers.
Yeah, that's the feeling I get. It's kind of like when you wake up, and if you had a dream, a really even a vivid dream, it just sort of like, kind of like mercury, just sort of starts frittering away, slipping away. Try to grasp it. It's kind of that's the way reality seems. It's kind of it keeps eluding us, because these forces, these mechanical forces that are trying to imitate nature and basically replace it with, some sort of mechanical reality, virtual reality. It's forcing the real world into the, like a dream. It's becoming like a dream.
Uh-huh. So jumping back to Hancock, he studies these ancient megalithic sites and comes up with theories about why there's huge megaliths with carving on them and what they mean. And he concludes in his latest book that these ancients may have built these megaliths before the last major catastrophic event that cut the human population almost down to nothing, like the flood event. And he suggests that maybe these megaliths were built with the statement to the future that this event happened to us and it's going to come around and happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically that I think more than one megalith has like this serpent and the astrological sign from 13,000 years ago, and our sign. It's like three simple things on this huge, I forget how heavy it was. There's megaliths like this in Indonesia, in the Middle East, and South America. And some of these megaliths were lowered down into holes and filled in with stones, as if they were meant to be time capsules.
Listen, John, this would be a subject that I'd really actually like to explore at greater depth. I'm not seeing exactly how, and I hate to be kind of a sort of dictator like here, but I'm just not seeing how it can be fruitfully integrated into the conversation that.
I agree that the system is not going to. Not fixable. I've said this on another show, I think on Positively Revolting, quoting Krishnamurti from India. He says, you can't reform the system because the establishment will resist. And so we have to revolutionize each one of ourselves. And that's the only way, which is what Buddha taught, original Jesus taught. And
okay.
You know, all great teachers taught.
All right. Well, thank you for that.
Thank you.
I think that revolutionary consciousness, for me, it's actually not an individual thing. I actually don't think the individual can revolutionize him, her, themself by his, her, themself. I think revolutionary consciousness is inherently a collective process, and that's when it does become a threat. And oh, I'm not saying we can change the way things are going, but I guess I'm saying is, let's at least try to get back, or try to get to, revolutionize ourselves together. And I think that's the route that we need to go. And I think there are people that are doing that. Like I say, I don't know. I've never participated in Democratic Socialist America. They seem to be kind of what's happening. As I said, there's these smaller groups, socialist groups, communist groups, other groups that, you know, tend to be somewhat more insular than DSA seems to be a little more open, or at least seems to people seem to be going towards it. And I don't want to get into a whole big debate about, you know, which ideology is better, which line is better. And I think all these groups should start working together more. You know, I personally, as I said, am not a Marxist in that I think this idea of a, you know, historical progress is a crock, and that's one of the things we actually need to get over. I think there needs to be anyway, I'll stop talking. I think we got a couple people on the line. Chris, I believe, is next. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Kwame Ture, formerly known as Stokely Carmichael, named himself after Sekou Ture and Kwame Nkrumah. He said, you know, no one man can make history. If that was true, I'd have made history a long time ago. And to the point about collective consciousness, collective revolutionary consciousness, it has to be collective. It has to begin with the individual, but it has to extend to the group. Otherwise, it's not, history will not be changed. In terms of this idea that progress is the opiate of liberals or liberal intellectuals, I think that that's true in a sense. There's nothing, because my perspective is that there's nothing inevitable about the future. Progress is always possible and it's always occurring.
But what is progress, though?
Right, and I was thinking about this. Right, what is progress? Well, progress is the I think, you know, different people could define it differently, but ultimately, I think it's the reduction in hierarchy and the increase in equitable free access to the things that we need in order to survive, that the systems that we do use are sustainable indefinitely. And I think that we could, I could say, is a working definition of progress.
So how would that be distinguished from, like, if I was to say that actually it was better, say, the Native Americans had it better, and so wouldn't it be something more like restoration? I think that's the thing I kind of point to, that I think we have this illusion, this Western or Eurocentric illusion that you know, we are the bringers of progress, even though you're saying something different in saying that, you're saying that no, we need to, you know, we need to get away from the way we are now, and that's what you're calling progress. I just think there's an illusion embedded in that I think we have to be aware of.
Yeah, and I think if, you know, and I'm a lover of words and their origins, and, you know, thinking about this term progress, right? Pro meaning forward or toward, right? I'm not sure exactly where the gress formation comes from, but it has to do with movement, right? There's regress, there's progress, there's ingress, there's egress, right? So it has to do with the movement, and progress implies then a forward movement, right? Which would imply that the past is regressive, which would have a negative connotation. And so hearing what you're saying, Paul, yeah, I totally agree. We should deconstruct that language and what it actually signifies subconsciously, and what it implies and what it connotes to us when we use that term.
Because there was a cyclic vision of the cosmos that was sort of embedded in, you know, if you read you know, a lot of ethnographers and even like religious history scholars, this idea of a cyclic view of the world as opposed to sort of the linear progress, which is
Right. Yeah. So what you're saying there is basically, if you look at non-European, non-Western perceptions of systems, time, and how things operate, it's very much cyclical. It's circular, right? Not linear. So I was going to say, you know, this quote-unquote progress, this the condition that I described, the way I define progress at the beginning, understanding the need to deconstruct that terminology, that I think this idea of achieving a status quo that is sustainable, that is equitable, I think it's always possible and it's always occurring in certain places at certain times, but collectively disaster is far more likely given our trajectory. In terms of the second point, is the system worth saving? I don't think the system is worth saving. I think that the systems that are most valuable are the natural systems that sustain us, and those be saved by any means necessary, and to the exclusion of any systems that threaten the natural systems that sustain us. And how could we do that? I would propose that we decouple ourselves, our families, and our communities from the global capitalist system by relocalizing and turning to each other. The last caller talked about how somebody he had read suggested that the solution was for us to talk to our neighbors more, and that we're talking to our neighbors less. And I think that's an indicator of, you know, the more likely disastrous future, although we're not dead yet, we're not there yet. And so we always have an opportunity to turn back and to do something different.
Well, the question is what are we, in some ways, what are we talking about? I mean, the idea of, you know, establishing relations to begin with is, you know, is not necessarily the easiest thing. I mean, I know that, you know, where I live, I just moved there with my mom, you know, about 3 years, two, three years ago. When was it? Jeez, 2 years ago, I think. Anyway, and, you know, it's not in this mass culture, you know, where we're all kind of alienated. We're all kind of have our own sort of a world, sort of inner worlds developed, our own cultural outlooks. It's not that easy to find time and space to talk, and you don't want to just start, you know, proselytizing or talking, you know, radical politics right off the bat. So yeah, that's a first step. But the other thing,
right, a barbecue is a great first step.
That's true. You know, and the city of Portland is making it easier for people to have block parties. You know, that's a good thing.
Yeah, but you know, I lived in the same neighborhood on the for 14 years. And we just moved 3 years ago, and we didn't realize how many relationships and how deep the relationships with our neighbors we had developed. And it really was just, you know, we lived on the corner of an elbow, and we would pull our grill out in the summertime, and we would put cones up and let the kids run in the street. And once we moved, we realized just how deeply those relations had been built in simple things. And, you know, I think it's a lot easier than we make it out to be.
Fair enough.
But we are so pulled apart by the system, and the system is not slowing down. It's getting faster. We're expected to do more in a day. You know, I'm sitting here in my car waiting to go into work, talking to you on a smartphone. That wouldn't have been possible 20 years ago. So, you know, the speed and the pace at which the system demands that we give it our time, energy, and life, you know, that's one of the things that we really have to kind of contend with. And I think if we become conscious of that, again, going back to another thing that Kwame Ture said, he said, we need to give the least amount of energy to these corporate systems that give us wages and do the absolute minimum that is possible in order to maintain the wages that system gives us. And we need to turn and give our heart and our soul and all of our energy to each other. And I think, you know, eventually we'll need to go farther than that, because, again, I don't believe that the system is worth saving. And I don't know that any energy that we put into the capitalist system is really benefiting us at all.
All right. Well, we got a couple other callers.
Okay. Can I say one last thing?
Yeah, go ahead.
About the murder of Fred Hampton. That's the film you were talking about.
Yep.
Love that film. I hope everybody watches it. You can see it on YouTube. And I agree that interaction was, to me, the most prescient interaction in the whole film. It displayed his incredible intellect at 21 years old. And he made a very almost prophetic comment there where he said, if you don't have a requirement for political education, then the people don't know. And they were talking about starting a bank, right? And he said, where's the money going to come from? And they said, oh, well, the people are going to give the money. He's like, well, why are they giving the money? And then he asked about the political education. They said, oh, well, that's a given. He said, no. You have to have political education, because otherwise the people don't know why they're giving the money to the bank. And if they don't know why they're giving the money to the bank, then you're going to end up having people running the bank and using the money just the way that the banks do. And he said, eventually you'll end up with a Negro imperialist.
Uh-huh.
And seeing the language of the time, and when I saw this film, Obama was in office, right? And to me, I thought that was incredible to see. You know, here's Obama, this, you know, the first black president, and I if you can't call him an imperialist, I don't know what you can call him.
Well, he's a figurehead at the head of an imperialist system. So by default, anyway, and thank you for bringing all those details that I didn't have it at the tip of my tongue. That's people really should see that film. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. And let's see. Wow. I've got this other thing I want to read. It's kind of a rhetorical, but anyway, I forget the website. I should have written it down. Revolutionary consciousness in Marxist thinking, the stage of awareness which follows class consciousness and is stimulated by perception of the cultural forces that construct class relations and their vulnerability to consciously directed overthrow that to bring about social change. Early Marxists tended to believe that historical forces alone, inevitably and without the need for intervention, eventually would bring about the social changes Marxist theory predicted, that is, the overthrow of the bourgeoisie by the proletariat. Later thinkers held that this process could be stimulated and sped up by the education of workers to bring them first to class consciousness and then to revolutionary consciousness. Like I say, this is kind of rhetorical. Anyway, neo-Marxists tend to discount the likelihood that revolutionary change is possible. But they sometimes use, quote, revolutionary consciousness to distinguish the heightened state of awareness they claim to derive when reading fully alert to the hidden cultural codes and processes which hide in the text. That brings a lot of kind of condenses a lot of cultural history. It's kind of dense, and you have to sort of already be tuned in to such a thinking and language. But anyway, okay, we got Tim, LJ, and Karen. Go ahead, Tim, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for letting me talk. Anyway, on the topic of consciousness, revolutionary consciousness, I believe I've worked in the past on reservations here in the U.S. and down in South America. And I worked with poor people. And I believe that revolutionary consciousness, first of all, comes about because of the social circumstances you're surrounded with and the events that might happen in an individual's life. In my example, for example, when I was very young, I was exposed to racism and poverty and injustice, and previous to that I was very naive and I knew it existed, but I had never seen it or experienced it. And when I did, that started me to question and reject all the all the stuff I had been shoveled full of that wasn't true. And I worked my way into a consciousness of change, which I believe is revolution. And later on, as an organizer, I would use, I was trained by ACORN and by People's Action. And I worked with Indians, Native Americans on a reservation in South Dakota, and Guarani Indians in Paraguay, and they were, especially the people in Paraguay, had no access to education, but they were under a fascist dictatorship, and they knew it. They were poor, they were not educated, but because of the circumstances they were surrounded in, they were becoming conscious of the fact that things were wrong, things had to change. And through organizing and empowerment and permaculture, we were able to even increase that consciousness even more.
Mm-hmm.
So, and as far as revolution is concerned, the ones who are true revolutionaries are not the ones just talking about it or running down the street freaking out. The ones who are revolutionaries are the ones who are building successful, replicable alternatives. Because if there's a revolution, a change, what are we going to have? We got to have something to replace what we're tearing down. So those who are building these structures now, those are the visionary revolutionaries laying the foundation. And then the individuals, once they have had things happen to them that turn them into revolutionaries, then they become the teachers of others, right? They become the organizers, the teachers, and they help to help others who maybe haven't had the luck of having had these things happen to them.
I guess the question I have is, what time scale are we looking at? Because I think, you know, I think the reality of climate change has really is something that a lot of political people haven't necessarily really taken into account, because it really changes the time frame. Because if you think, like maybe people did, revolutionaries, radicals, change
right.
agents did in the past, that, you know, this sort of indefinite future that we're working towards, but climate change has really changed that for me anyway.
Still, unless it gets to the really extreme point where it's not even viable to survive, then there will be areas and people who will survive. And those people had better be thinking about preparation before it hits them. And I think those of us who believe in a progressive and just society and want to make something better, we better start organizing together. Like you had said, the leaders, different groups, they need to sit their butts down and talk seriously about what are they going to do. And individuals, if you can't get the leaders of the organizations, then individuals, say a group of families in Portland or Salem or wherever, they should start sitting down and provide and thinking about what they can do as a group to survive and help others that they care about.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your contribution. I appreciate that. We got a couple other callers.
Namaste.
All right. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. We're having one of our free-flowing conversations about progress. Is progress the opiate of liberal intellectuals? Is the system we're saving? And I do want to say, we kind of veered into, you know, talking about, is the system of capitalism we're saving? The original spur was really that my fellow co-host Joe Uris threw out, that, you know, we really need to save the kind of democratic constitutional framework, which is under threat, and in fact seems to be heading towards a constitutional crisis, just to be fair to the original context in which is a whole subject that we really haven't talked about, the relationship between that system and, you know, this the economic capitalist system that we're talking about. Anyway, don't have much time to talk about that, but coming up this morning at 9, in just about 7 minutes, is The Politics of Living, Women's Voices and Opinions on Economic, Social, and Cultural Issues. After that, Air Cascadia at 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and 11, The Bike Show. As always, thank all you KBOO members for your support, and thank of all you for listening, even if you are not a member, but we do encourage you to go to kbo.fm and click on Donate to become a member, or go to the other parts of the website, check about volunteering, and various ways to get involved here. Anyway, this is Wednesday Talk Radio, as I said. Let's see. We've got LJ. Go ahead. You're up.
Hey, good morning, Paul. How are you?
Go ahead.
All right. Here we go. First of all, I got to preface my remarks by saying I am a Marxist. So what I'm going to say is from a Marxist point of view. All right. Marx said that the working class creates the surplus but has no say in how the surplus is distributed. Decisions, corporate decisions, are made by a board of directors, and there is not one working class person who sits on the board of directors. All right, point number one. Point number two, a couple of books that I'd like to recommend. Capitalism Hits the Fan, by Richard Wolff, who's a Marxist economist. And I'm reading a book right now by a fellow by the name of Yanis Varoufakis, and it's called, and it's Europe's Crisis and the American Economic Future, and the weak suffer what they must. All right. And my answer would be, I am with the Radical Elders Reading Group. We meet on Thursdays at, in other words, from 1 to 2:30. We'll be changing locations here very, very soon to a place called The Flip Side, which is right next door. And the book we're reading now is The Starfish and the Spider, The Unstoppable Power of Leaderless Organizations. All organizations that have a hierarchy have always been destroyed. The reason that Geronimo was so successful in fighting the Spanish for 25 years is because the Apache system is essentially a fluid system, and there is not one location. And one more thing, for my evangelical Christian friends, what kind of car would Jesus drive? Have a nice day.
All right. Thank you, LJ. And, wow, I don't know. I guess we got Karen up. You only have a couple minutes. Go ahead. You're on the air. Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Well, these aren't short thoughts, but I'll just raise some questions. And it goes back to Joe Urus and the idea of, is there anything in our current system worth saving? And I think, obviously, rules and laws, especially...
Liam, could you take that phone off? Oh, there we go. I don't know what's going on. Well, we're about out of time anyway, so let's just... sorry, Karen. We're just going to have to end that on that note. That's all right. Anyway, so Chumbawamba. Check out Chumbawamba. What a great band. Also, I was going to play a couple songs from Leon Rosselson, but we got into such a great conversation. I'm going to be actually interviewing him on my second Thursday folk show. It's coming up on his 84th birthday. I just want to give myself a little plug. Leon Rosselson, the great, great English radical singer, songwriter. Early in the morning, so those of you early risers... The Money Cult, check that out. And all the books that our readers, our listeners so kindly suggested, Zombie Capitalism, I didn't write them all down. Capitalism Hits the Fan. All right, it's coming up on 8:58. We got to make room for a few messages and then the politics of living. Thank you all so much for listening, and thank you for calling in, and look forward to talking with you next week, probably with my co-host Jacqueline Keeler. Bye bye.
Good morning, it's your lucky day, because I've come to help you make the grade. I'm your friend, I'm your neighbor, I'm your group companion.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present the live broadcast for the 26th annual Good in the Hood Multicultural Music, Arts, and Food Festival. This three-day celebration kicks off Friday, June 22nd, with the Good in the Hood Parade and Festival continuing Saturday, June 23rd, and ending Sunday evening, June 24th. Good in the Hood is back at King School Park at Northeast Grand Avenue. Tune into KBOO starting Saturday afternoon on June 23rd for the live broadcast. More information about Good in the Hood can be found on the KBOO.fm website on the home page.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. And here's what we have coming up for you for the remainder of the morning on KBOO. Coming right up, it's Politics of Living, Women's Voices and Opinions on Economic, Social, and Cultural Issues. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, Headlines, Interviews, and Commentary. Chris Andre brings you that. And then at 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein at the helm. And at 11 o'clock, we've got The Bike Show. It brings you news and views about cycling from Portland and elsewhere, and we thank you KBOO members for your generous support. You can stay informed and you can even get involved down here. Start it all off by going to kboo.fm and click on donate to become a member. Now we get right to Politics of Living.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Politics of